Today's episode is brought to you by Slay House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
So today we have a very special interview with Rich Hanley. He is comics historian, editor, writer, Lord God of, what was that?
Emperor of the Universe.
Lord God, Emperor of the Universe, to Alpha Centauri at least. So, hey, Rich, welcome to our welcome to our show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course. Yes, definitely. We are very, very excited about this. I know you and Trevor have had a lot of interactions. Oh, thank you. My secretary brought me the water, so...
don't mind if I do.
I'll have a Sambuca, please.
There you go, yeah. We also have donuts here, Rich, if we can, like, pass them through the computer screen.
Sounds good, but, yeah. I don't think technology has allowed that yet, so I appreciate the offer.
We're waiting.
We really need to push into that utopian dream where, you know, you just ask for whatever you want and it comes out of a machine, right?
We're very close, Trevor.
Yeah. So we're really excited to have you on board. I know you and Trevor, Trevor, do you want to kind of take over a little bit here?
I mean, Rich, you've worked on a lot of stuff, kind of across the nerd universe a little bit, you know? I think perhaps you're best known for your work on Star Trek and Star Trek comics, but you've also worked in Star Wars. You've done essays on Batman, you've done essays on Dark Shadows, you've done, just so much stuff. Can you walk us through a little bit of your career in publishing?
Sure. My writing career started in like the early to mid 90s. I was doing work for the Star Wars franchise for Lucasfilm. Short stories, a lot of role-playing game materials and magazine articles and so forth. And from there, I sort of transferred away from that into the Star Trek franchise. I used to be a reporter for the Star Trek Communicator, and it just sort of went from there. You guys are younger than me, so I don't know if you remember the Communicator. Unfortunately, it went away years ago, but it was an amazing magazine, and I loved working for that. But over the years, I've continued to work for the Star Trek franchise. The most recent thing was for the past several years. I was the editor of Eagle Moss's Star Trek graphic novel collection. Like you said, I've written for a lot of different things. I'm lucky in that regard. I mean, I will never take it for granted how fortunate I've been in that regard. You know, like I'm humbled and happy to be able to have done it, but it's because of publishers like Sequart and Boom Studios and others that have had me come in and write about comics. Not so much write comics, unfortunately, but writing about comics. I'm doing something for IDW that I can't talk about, but I'll let you know when I can.
Oh man, your IDW projects, I think, are some of the coolest projects I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Yeah, no. I talked a little bit to Dean Mullaney at the Library of American Comics I was kind of like getting into my dissertation. He was a super cool guy. He was really generous.
Dean is awesome.
Yeah, he was really generous in sharing some research material with me on a project that I was working on. It was so cool. But in my, you know, love for all things, you know, comics, all things, especially like newspaper comics, I came across, you know, several of the projects that you had worked on in conjunction with IDW and the Library of American Comics. Could you talk a little bit about, those Star Trek strips that you collected?
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's actually an interesting story. At least I think so. But who knows? Maybe you all will not. but I do. I've been a Star Trek comics collector since I was a teenager. And I remember still the first time that I picked up a Star Trek comic. It was DC Comics issue number 9. I was never a comics reader before this. And it was right after Star Trek III came out, and I was walking through a Walden Books when Walden Books started.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. And at the time, you know, there was like a Star Trek novel occasionally. It wasn't like the constant outpouring that it became. So I would frequent Walden Books and look for the new one. And I walked past a comic rack and went, what is that? You know, sadly, this is not a visual podcast, but I just did a Scooby-Doo double take. basically, it was the Mirror Universe crew, and I just said, I have to read this. And then I thought, well, comics at the time were like, what was it, 75 cents? So even if it sucked, it wouldn't matter, right? And but it turned out that I loved it, and I just kept reading them. And in short order, even though I was a teenager at the time, I managed to track down everything that came before that. And over the years, I just kept collecting the comics, and I prided myself in saying I had everything. Then in the 90s, my friend Ben Sastro-Doyle, and I'm giving him a call out because he's responsible for all this, went to a convention, and he kind of prided himself in making me surprised. So he walked in one day and handed me a comic that he had found, and he said, do you have this? And I thought, of course I, wait, what? No, I don't. and what it was a British magazine called TV 21. From back in the early, very early 70s, and it had a Star Trek comic in it, and it was original. My jaw hit the floor because it was number 72.
Oh, wow.
Which meant there were at least 71 more comics I didn't own. But it turns out there were more than that because there were a total of 256 issues.
Oh, my gosh.
And I thought, you have got to be kidding me. This was pre-internet, you know. I mean, it existed, but it's not like in its current form. So finding it was especially difficult since this was only published in Britain and was the kind of thing that most people forgot about even existing. So tracking these things down was not easy. It took me many years, but I managed to find them all because I have a very, very, very patient wife who did not leave me. And right around the halfway point when I managed to have, you know, it's like wow, I've actually found outlets to be able to find these. I came across evidence that another series of strips existed in the United States. And I thought, oh my God, no. And that ran for 5 years daily from the Los Angeles Times Syndicate. And I thought, the universe hates me. I don't know how I can explain this to my wife and stay married. So, But did a lot more searching, and over time somehow I managed to complete both runs. So now I had 9 years worth of weekly and daily comic strips that most fans did not know existed. And I thought, what can I do with this? I want to share these things. I don't want to be the only one who has these. And so I started reaching out to various publishers, and there were legal reasons why at the time, the paperwork was lost. They weren't sure on Paramount's end at the time what the contracts were like. And so that got put on hold. So instead, I reached out to Larry Nemechek at the Star Trek Communicator and pitched an article on these. And Larry was really so excited and said, absolutely. That was the first my first Star Trek work. And I wrote an article about that for the Communicator, which led to my becoming a columnist for that magazine. But I kept wanting to get these things reprinted. And so over the years, I kept reaching out to different publishers. And each case, it was the same. It happened to Pocket Books. It happened with Wildstorm. They wanted to do it. And Paramount's legal division said, there's reasons why we can't do this. And then right around, I guess it was 2012, I said, you know, I'm doing this one more time. I'm like, the heartache is just too much. But these things are sitting on my shelves, and they need to be shared. So I reached out one day to Chris Ryall at IDW and said, okay, here's what I have. Would you be interested in reprinting it? About an hour later, I heard from Chris who said, this is amazing. I've been wanting to reprint these for a while but didn't have a source for these. And I said, well... here. And so here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to have you reprint all these materials. And this was a great way for me to position myself to have a job. I said, I'd like to, you know, help you put these collections together and write all the supplementary materials for each volume. And to my great surprise, they said yes. And next thing I knew, I was working with Dean on 5 hardcover books, and 3 for the British strips and 2 for the U.S. strips, which is funny because the U.S. strips are so much better. They should have had the 3 books, but what could you do? When that was all over, Dean had me also help him reprint all of the Star Wars newspaper strips, and I did the same function for those.
Yeah, yeah, those Star
Wars.
Long
story there, sorry, but that's what basically happened.
Oh no, absolutely worth it for sure.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
Fun little epilogue to that. Several years later, I started doing the Eagle Moss books, and before I became the editor, I was just a guy writing introductions to those books. Because I kind of made a name for myself by that point as a Star Trek comics guy. And so when Eagle Moss started doing these books under a different editor, they hired me to write the introductions to them. And one day my editor said, "Hey, are you familiar with these really obscure comic strips from Britain? And we're going to be reprinting those, and we'd like you to write an introduction if you have any knowledge of them." And I thought, wow, okay. Yes, I do know of those. And so then I wrote the introduction, and only after I turned it in did I say, by the way, the books that you're reprinting that I just wrote the introduction for, they're all scanned from my personal collection.
That's awesome.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
So would you say that it was really Star Trek that kind of pulled you into this world of pop culture, because you've worked on a lot of projects that's not just Star Trek.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, I know that you've you just told us that Star Wars was kind of the first stuff that you wrote, but where did your passion for this stuff kind of begin?
This is going to set me up for all your listeners as the geeky mama's boy, but my mother. My mom was a first generation Star Trek fan, I was born in 68, so I can truthfully say that I watched the original Star Trek for 1 year. However, I also was wearing diapers at the time, so I don't remember any of it. But when I grew up, she was a major fan of Planet of the Apes, Twilight Zone, Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Star Trek, The Outer Limits. So I grew up, Dark Shadows, I grew up in a house where my mom was always watching this stuff. And so it was just natural that as I grew older, that's where my passion went. Her favorite show was Star Trek and The Twilight Zone. And so I grew up watching them a lot. Star Wars is the first franchise work I did, but Star Trek is probably my mainstay. And also Planet of the Apes. I did a lot of Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I remember you writing a lot of the Planet of the Apes essays, and kind of running across them on social media as you were talking about them.
It was, in fact, the same exact kind of work as I just said for the IDW books, because Boom Studios reprinted the whole Marvel run of Planet of the Apes, and I wrote all the supplementary materials for those books, too.
Oh, wow.
So basically the same thing.
Right, yeah, yeah. That's really interesting. So, I mean, a lot of these pop culture franchises are like really important to people, The Kenobi trailer just dropped.
Looks good.
I know. I'm really excited about it, but there are some fans who are not excited about it. They're like really kind of vitriolic about it.
In any fandom, you're going to have to be very careful what I say here. I've gotten myself in trouble. In any fandom, you're going to have an element that seems to view fandom as a reason to be angry. I've never really understood that. I welcome all viewpoints. Well, I don't welcome racism, but I mean, I welcome all viewpoints about a franchise. And if people dislike something, they're still fans. If they like this and you don't, they're still fans. I the whole true fan thing never made any sense to me. But I also think that people spend way too much time being angry about something that they're supposed to be enjoying. If you don't like Kenobi, don't watch it. If you didn't like the Star Wars prequels, don't watch them. If you don't like Star Trek Discovery, don't watch it. You have 10 other Star Trek shows.
That's right.
And I just think people spend way too much time getting angry about this. Look, the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes film is not a masterpiece. But there are 8 other Planet of the Apes movies, right? So, like, yeah. Why get angry about it?
Yeah,
that's a good perspective. A good I like that.
I like how, like, I'm really into the doors open, right? Like, you can enjoy this stuff too, right?
Yeah.
So when it comes to, you know, some of this this community of nerds, whether well-meaning or maybe not as well-meaning.
Sometimes.
Yeah, sometimes. You know, how do you kind of approach some of those communities who resist your efforts to kind of like historicize some of these franchises in their political moments?
I ran into that head first with the Planet of the Apes books. that was a weird time. Writing about the Marvel Planet of the Apes stories required that I get political. I had to, because the original Planet of the Apes movies are political, and anyone who doesn't think that hasn't seen the original Planet of the Apes movies.
Totally.
You know, the fourth one is a metaphor for the civil rights movement. You know, I mean, it's like, so there's a lot going on there. And so I wrote these essays for these books, framing the Planet of the Apes movies, from the standpoint of how in Marvel, there were these groups called the ape supremacists who rode around on horses with white hoods, killing people who believed in equality among humans and apes. And I said, well, this is a pretty blatant parallel. I was talking about what was going on. And I had people coming at me claiming that I was, never in my life have I been called this, a race traitor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And tried to get me fired from several different publishers because I was a hate monger, simply because I said that racists wearing hoods, riding around on horses, setting fire to things, could be a parallel to the Ku Klux Klan. I don't know what I was thinking.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Clearly, I was way off base on this. They're nice people who help their moms on Sunday. So for whatever reason, that really triggered people. But here's a question I have for you, because this is what I always ponder when things like that happen. When you have a franchise like Planet of the Apes or Star Trek or Twilight Zone, where the entire basis of it is on the idea that fascism is bad and racism is bad, what draws those people to these franchises? Why would a bigot enjoy Star Trek? Why would a bigot enjoy Planet of the Apes? I'm often left really fascinated by this. Is it a disconnect that they simply aren't mentally equipped to recognize the messages being tossed to them? Or are they actually perceiving the message as the exact opposite of what it is? I don't know. Like, do they see Captain Kirk as a David Duke parallel?
Oh my gosh.
I don't know. Like, yeah. I wonder what is it about Star Trek or Planet of the Apes that would actually appeal to a bigot? I don't get it.
Just like everything else, they probably interpret it however they feel like interpreting it.
Well, so this is a really interesting question, because, you know, I teach world literature, and I'm frequently, you know, running across kids who don't necessarily know how to read critically. And I think part of that is kind of learned. When I open the class, I always say, one of the things that we're going to have to understand as we enter into this is that all art is political. Mm-hmm. And I think that even the art that claims to be apolitical is a political statement, right? The depoliticization of art is still a political play.
Right.
So in order for us to understand anything, any art we come across, we need to be searching for what was this political moment? What were the cultural influences on this text? What are the social influences on this text? what are the economic influences on this text? You know, when we read like Tang poetry or poetry from that period in China's history, you know, we kind of need to understand this was poetry that was kind of expected of everyone of a certain a certain age, a certain political class, a certain literacy level, right? And although this was really proliferate, is that a word? I just invented that word.
Sure, we'll take it.
I mean, although it was, it was everywhere. We still have to kind of understand the people who were creating these were the people who held positions of power, right? The average person, the normal person, the person who's working a field somewhere, wasn't necessarily educated in this poetry. So we get a lot of beautiful poetry, but it is also a snapshot of poetry from a cultural elite. So we kind of have to, we kind of have to adjust our expectations a little bit when we encounter this stuff.
Right.
I look at these people, from another perspective. I look at these people who are, the prejudiced people, the biased people, the bigots or whatever that are drawn to these shows. I feel like from my interactions with them, they are institutionalized in their own upbringing. So be it through church or through their own prejudices introduced by their family,
they've been indoctrinated.
Indoctrinated, yeah. Yes, definitely. And yeah. Mm-hmm. And they so that kind of hinders their own ability to critically analyze anything else. So they're very much the people who believe that art exists in this kind of vacuum, and they don't see it as relating to mm-hmm. the rest of the world when that's absolutely not the case.
Right.
Yeah.
I think Star Trek and Planet of the Apes and I mean to some extent Star Wars, although it's a very different franchise, but science fiction in general has to be viewed through the lens of the era in which it was produced. Mm. I mean, when people complain about modern day Star Trek being different from 1960 Star Trek, the answer is obvious. It's not the 1960s.
Right.
I mean, are they different shows? Yes. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, and I love the original show. But if you have if you were to make the 1960s show today, in which all the women wore miniskirts and said, "Captain, I'm frightened," instead of having meaningful roles, I mean, that would be a bad thing, right? So, the lens of criticism needs to be one of it's based on the era in which something came out, and I think sometimes that the people watching things are, I don't know if it's willful or it's definitely ignorance, but I don't know if it's willful or ignorance that prevents them from seeing the bigger picture. And when I had people coming at me for the outrageous assumption that Planet of the Apes was political, I still can't grasp my head about it. That's like complaining that Harlequin novels have sex in them. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense at all. Like I'm offended. I went on Pornhub last night and there was nudity. I'm really offended by this.
Very inappropriate.
I went on the news and people were wearing suits. I'm just like, what in the world? And giving headlines,
Right.
Like I don't understand. Like, well, what's your expectation when you go into watching science fiction from the 60s if you're not expecting a political statement to be made? Right? What can you do?
I love the idea of people being like Planet of the Apes is apolitical or non-political when like the whole punchline of that movie is Charlton Heston staring at the Statue of Liberty and being like,
yes, right.
you madmen, you wrecked it, damn you.
The entire point of those five movies is that religious dogmatism and anti-science and fascism and hatred led to the fall of mankind and replacement replacement by another species.
Yeah.
And here's the kicker: it may have been divine will because we suck so much, right? So, how do you not view that in a political light. It's staggering, and frankly, it's impressive. I'm actually impressed that somebody got through those movies and didn't make the connection. It's not many people would be able to pull that off. That's impressive.
It really does kind of reframe the whole movie. I just liked it for the monkeys.
Exactly, yeah. I'm really into paws.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So
I like the color green. The color green is pretty. That's what Planet of the Apes is about, the green of the chimp outfit. It's a fashion movie.
Yeah, there you go.
Just whatever you want to
do. Maybe
right?
They were just fans of Charlton Heston's, like, NRA years, right?
See, it's funny you say that, because I remember when the Tim Burton movie came out, and they were so offended that they had that Cheston. Kids don't do drugs. That Charlton Heston, although from here in shall be known as Cheston.
But that
his character made an anti-gun statement, and to that I say, putting aside everything else I just said, get a sense of humor, right?
Yeah.
That's one thing that is missing. People just are so unwilling to laugh. I try to laugh every day. I try to laugh every hour. And so many people don't get that. And I think that that's why fandom has become such an angry place. People forget how to laugh.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I don't know if I could go through a day without it. We laugh at ourselves every episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you want a really good laugh, listen to our early episodes. Like, they're pretty funny.
Yeah, it's
clown show. Yeah.
Yeah.
So sometimes intentionally too.
So how long does it typically take you to do the research for some of your projects when you do, like, edit a book and you write that really well researched preface?
Oh, wow. There's such a huge variation. It depends on the franchise. It depends on my passion for it. It depends on how much literature is out there, or how many episodes. It depends on if I've eaten breakfast or whether or not there's a movie I'd really prefer to be watching instead of writing. There's a lot, you know, so it depends. Case in point, the most recent thing I worked on was that I contributed an afterword to a book about Dark Shadows from Jim Beard and Charles Rutledge. And the book is all about how children in the 60s rushed home every day to watch Dark Shadows after school, and how those same people are now writers in their 50s and 60s. and their careers go back to the fact that when they were little kids, they rushed. They could not, everything had to be put on hold so they could see a vampire who had started out as a rapey serial killer but ended up a show's hero. I was 3 when that show ended, so I can't truthfully say that I was one of those kids because I wasn't in school. But my mother was a fan, and so I wrote the afterword to this book from the standpoint of everybody else in the book is the first generation fan. What's their legacy? The legacy is people like me who were the second generation that kept it going. And so that one, to answer your question, took me 2 hours. From the moment Jim invited me to do it, I turned it in 2 hours later. And the reason was I was passionate about this. It was a fun topic. It didn't require a lot of research. And most importantly, I had recently finished rewatching the whole show, and it was therefore in my memory. But when it comes to something else where there's a lot of research involved, it takes up a lot of my time. I write a weekly column for Hero Collector about Star Trek comics. It's been going now for several years. I've been running from the 60s to the present, looking at how every story that's been published approaches Star Trek from the idea of prequels, sequels, and tie-ins to on-screen Star Trek. So if I'm writing about a story that had no prequels, sequels, and tie-ins, it's actually a pretty quick article. If I'm writing one that is a sequel to 15 different episodes, there's a lot of research. And my friend Joe Dilworth and I just turned in a manuscript to Sequart for a book about Stargate. And that required a lot of research that sucked. I'll tell you why. Because my essay for that book was on the cartoon Stargate Infinity.
Oh, wow.
And Stargate Infinity is the... I love this franchise. I love every other version of Star Trek. But Stargate Infinity is the televised equivalent of a burrito fever dream. And having just sit and watch it all was interesting. But I knew that nobody else involved in the book would volunteer to watch that and write an essay about it, because it's, who wants to watch 26 episodes with no redeeming value? So I'm a team player, and I said, I got this, guys. So for that, yes, there was a lot of work, none of it fun. But it was, and yeah, at the same time, and this is the key, incredibly enjoyable. Because I joke around about the burrito dream and all that, but the truth is, I wouldn't do any of this if I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Right. And anyone who is doing this kind of work has to enjoy it. It has to be the reason you're doing it. You don't make a lot of money at it. So there's no reason to watch 26 episodes of a really terrible cartoon from an era of terrible cartoons. that is single-handedly the worst thing about a franchise, unless you have a reason to do that. And in my case, it's because it was just a lot of fun to try to come at the essay, not from a vitriolic standpoint, but from the standpoint of, okay, is there value in this? Is there a reason? Is there something I can take from this that is not crap? And... yeah, there is, actually. I had fun looking at it from that standpoint. Yeah. So that required a lot of work. The Dark Shadows essay poured out of me faster than I could write it.
That's awesome.
Very
That's
cool.
Awesome. I love that approach to, you know, I've been on this journey to reread. I'm going to drop my stupid Star Wars update. I've been on this journey to try to read every Star Wars novel.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, yeah.
Are right. you planning to live to be 263 years old?
Right. No, that's exactly right. I didn't realize how much Star Wars there was when I started this dumb project. It has just consumed, like, my entire life for the last year, as I've been, you know, just kind of like slowly going through it with some of the other literature that I read, and some of it is, I think, like, some of the best Star Wars I've encountered. I absolutely love it. And then there's some of it that I'm like, this is so bad. It's just so bad.
Back when I was doing Lucas from work, I had to read everything, and sometimes that was a good thing. Sometimes. Well, yeah.
Okay, so
I'm not going to say which ones I dislike. I'm not going to, you know, I won't do that. But I
can respect that. I think the thing that I really have to express is because I know a lot of these creators are, you know, they're still making stuff. They're still writing. You know, I think Kevin J. Anderson is still just, you know, kind of cranking some stuff out. And
I think he has a Dune book every 12 minutes, if I remember correctly.
I think you are right, Rich. I am almost positive that's the
you know,
real truth.
People will say what they will. I know Kevin has both his fans and detractors, but I am in awe of his output.
It's incredible.
I wish I was even a tenth as prolific as Kevin. He sneezes novels.
Yeah,
I don't know. I've never in my life seen anybody able to write a book as fast as he does, and I'm in awe of it. You know?
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. I come across these projects, and I think to myself, you know, some of these are really just not very good, and yet at the same time, there's so much joy I get out of the process of you know, engaging with that piece of fiction. And when it comes to, you know, like writers like Kevin, I think that, like, what the ideas he has and how he kind of cranks this stuff out is really incredible. It's really impressive. And I think it's just fascinating to me that there's so much of it.
You know, Kevin contributed a short story to an essay okay, that made no sense. I just said he contributed a short story to an essay anthology. Why would you ever submit a short story to an essay anthology? Yeah. Anyway, he submitted a short story to a short story anthology that I edited for Titan Books with Jim Beard called Tales from the Forbidden Zone. It was a Planet of the Apes short story anthology. And so we invited a bunch of authors to submit ideas, and we encouraged them to think outside the box, because we knew if we didn't do that, everybody was going to pitch us a love story about Cornelius and Zira because everyone loves them. And I joked around that if that happened, we'd have to name the book Zira Loves Cornelius. And I was like, I don't want to do that. You know, I was hoping we'd get at least one, and we did. But because we encouraged everyone to do this, we got some wild ideas. And Kevin's was about dinosaurs.
Oh, wow.
And it worked. Yeah, it was fun. Fun story. I when he pitched it, Jim and I were like, huh, you know what? That's just so crazy. It might work. And it was a lot of, it was a fun story. It really was.
Yeah. I in retrospect, I really loved the Jedi Academy trilogy that he wrote. In the moment, I was not very appreciative of it because I was like, Kevin's, I don't know, it felt really thin in places. But I think he understands the characters really, really well. I think he understands, you know, like what the stakes are and why, you know, we should kind of invest in a story around these characters. I think it's really cool.
I'm an unabashed fan of the Jedi Academy books. I know before when I said that he has his fans and his detractors, I know that those were the books I was thinking about.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. Yep.
They seem to polarize readers. But you know, I loved them. I thought that they were fun.
Yeah.
And honestly, any book that has the balls to create blobstacle races, I respect.
Man, you know what? We talked.
Blobstacles were hilarious. I don't care what anybody said.
When we did our Star Wars update, the two things we talked about the most was the blobstacle race and Han Solo's weekend skiing with Kip Durant.
With Kip.
Yeah.
Skiing with Kip.
But Star Wars, I think people sometimes forget that Star Wars at its core is fun.
Oh, yeah. Right? It's got to be goofy, right?
And that's what Kevin gets right. No writer gets it perfectly right. But one thing I think I really enjoy about Kevin's Star Wars work is he has a sense of giddy fun that comes across. He gets that this universe is supposed to make you chuckle.
And not only that, but I think that, again, coming back to his characters and the way that he really builds on those characters, he just gets it. He gets the spirit of what these characters are supposed to represent. He understands the arc, the emotional arc that they're supposed to go through. I've been recently reading the Jedi Academy, or not the Young Jedi Knight series, right? With Han Solo's kids that he wrote with Rebecca, his wife. And those books are like unabashedly some of the most fun I've had with Star Wars.
Oh yeah, those are fun. Those are really good books.
Yeah. They're great.
They're not, and they're not even really young adult fiction, even though that's how they're marketed. They're just good Star Wars.
Yeah, no, I agree. And the lessons that these kids have to kind of learn, and the mature decisions they have to make about the mistakes that they make, I think are just great. It's really good fiction. So I want to talk to you. This is just kind of an aside, but we need to talk to you about Max Rebo.
Well, that's not a question. Yeah, I actually forgot all about that. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
No, so we were just, when Max Rebo kind of resurfaced in the Book of Boba Fett, you had a kind of an anecdote about, you know, being the guy who wrote Max Rebo's backstory for Star Wars. Was it Star Wars Insider? Or?
Yeah, back when I used to write for the Insider, they wanted to... Well, the special editions, keep in mind that I'm older now. My memory is not always 100%. This is like many jobs ago. But I think, and I know there's going to be somebody out there going, well, I've just checked Wikipedia and he's got his dates wrong by a month. But I think that this was after the special editions had come out, I think was why they chose to do it. The Insider wanted to update the existing backstory for what was originally three members of the band. It was now a dozen. And around the same time that this came out, the Dark Horse's Star Wars Tales had added a Max Rebo wannabe, like their biggest fanboy. It's a pretty funny story. Tick Talash, I think his name was. about this guy who follows Max Rebo Band around but like a groupie and wants to join. And so that had just come out, and I thought, all right, if they're going to have me write this, I'm having Tick Talash join the Max Rebo Band. So that's one thing. That was my goal. But yeah, so basically I said, all right, well, I hear all these characters who suddenly are the Max Rebo Band in the special edition. I'm going to have fun with this. And there was some stuff that had already been established. It wasn't like I created all of it. But I wrote, a lot of it was new material that I came up with, and some of it was stuff that had been done elsewhere. And one thing I was relatively proud of myself for, but more than anything, just really surprised that Lucasfilm even allowed this, was that I said, well, nobody names their kid Max Rebo. I realize this is Star Wars where people have goofy names like Sleaze Bagano, but I don't think his name was Max Rebo when he was born. Like, I doubt there was like Johnny and Mary Rebo who said, we just had our blue elephant kid, and in our family, every child is named Max, and we're going to continue this tradition. I don't think that's what happened. So I came up with the name Cerulean Fantel. Cerulean
I love it.
Differently, which is means blue. And Fantel being an anagram of elephant. So Max Rebo's real name is Blue Elephant. But because I came up with a weird sci-fi spelling of the word Cerulean, and, you know, it's not elephant, it's Fantella, I wasn't sure if anybody caught on. And what really struck me as funny is it was years later before anybody asked me, are you the idiot who named Max Rebo Blue Elephant? And I'm like, yes! Yes, I am!
Oh, man, I love it.
But here's the cool thing. I know that Kenner started coming out with figures of these characters. And I think it was, again, someone's going to correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure it was Rapper Toonie, where the name I came up with ended up on the Kenner card. I think it was that one. Rapatalana Watney Tiv Totalon, I think is the name I came up with. Yeah, Rapatalana Watney, I think. Because I said Rapper Toonie, nobody names their kid Rapper Toonie. These are musicians. There's not Mr. and Mrs. Toonie, and they name their kid Rapper. These are musicians, you know. Like, they obviously, so I need, like, these people have to have real names. And I think it was Rapper Toonie where the card the card back had the name I created, and I said, I'm done. I can die now. No one knows it, but I'm on a Kenner. I'm on a Star Wars action.
Like a Star Wars action figure card.
I'm done.
That's incredible.
I remember too. You tried to rename the musical genre of Star Wars, and it didn't take.
Sort of. That's not actually. It's you're close. I was using the name that actually already existed. West End Games, I think it was, had called the music, the type of music that is sung in the Cantina band,
right,
scenes, jizz.
Yeah. We've been around this block before, for sure.
Yeah. Endless you fun. Know, you'd think that when they heard that, somebody would have gone, come on.
Come on.
Anyway, given that this had long been established, I had pointed out that, in effect, it had been established for the character of Ivar Orbis, was, I think the character's name was, the manager of the... God, I haven't even thought about these names for so many years. But... It's from one of the guys who formed. I don't remember this anymore. And I wrote the damn thing. Oh man, that's really sad. But in any case, the whole genre of music was called jizz wailing, which is hilarious. And I wanted to use that term, not thinking anybody would have a problem with it. 10 years of Lucasfilm using the term jizz whaling. Okay, sure. You know, like, I want to make a joke there, and I'm not going to. So I got the feedback I got was, oh, no, we can't use the word jizz. And I insert Scooby-Doo double take here because, like, but you've been doing that for 10 years. I didn't come up with this. So I was like, okay, they said you have to come up with another word for it. I'm like, but that's like, what? There's a name for it. How am I supposed to, like, I'm going to be the asshole, right? All of fandom is going to say, this guy doesn't know what it's called. How, you know, go hire him. Okay, so they're like, we're going to call it Jez, J-E-Z-Z. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's so much better.
Jez.
That's so much better. Like, to just be one letter off of a sexual innuendo. That makes right. so much sense. Yeah, I don't even remember what it ended up being. But I just remember doing a massive facepalm when they told me that you can't use the word that exists already for this music, and stop being a pervert. Okay.
Yeah. Oh,
I mean, it was,
gosh.
It was, you know, I chuckled about it afterwards, but I'm like, I really am going to be viewed as the guy who doesn't know the trivia. And
so as yeah. someone who has both adapted, you know, kind of stories from a franchise into another medium, right? What do you think goes into creating a successful adaptation from one medium to another?
When you say what goes into it, do you mean on the corporate end or on the creative end?
No, I think more on like the maybe the creative end, right? Because I think of a lot of these cross-media promotions, you know, whether it be the novelization of Star Trek or, you know, the novelization of Star Wars, or like Star Trek, which I think has a really rich tradition in comic books, right? Mm-hmm. As well as television and film, you know, all of right. these being very different mediums. How do you create something that feels consistent, and what makes for a good adaptation?
Well, I, you know, anyone who's ever worked on any kind of franchise work can tell you that one of the hardest things to do when you approach a short story or a comic or a supplementary role-playing game material for a franchise is the knowledge that people are going to be viewing it with the eye of, did he get it or did she get it right? You know, do they know what they're doing? Does this seem like the franchise that I'm used to? So what goes into it is several different things. One, an understanding of the material. Two, hopefully a good idea for something new. I mean, sequels are great. I mean, as I already said, I write a weekly column about sequels, so clearly I like them. But if all you do is just rehash something that's already been done, that gets boring really fast. I can use the book Tales from the Forbidden Zone as an example. One of the things that we were so excited about when we got our pitches is that every writer came in, and these were all established novelists. Every writer came in with their own unique perspective on the universe. And so what went into making that book was taking seriously the word tales in the title, the idea that these are different perspectives on Planet of the Apes that you might not have thought about before. I think one thing that any editor or any writer, if they're well chosen, there are probably some for whom this isn't true, but if they're well chosen, they're thinking about not how does the franchise serve me, but how can I serve the franchise?
Mm.
In the end, if you're being hired to write a Star Wars or Star Trek or Planet of the Apes or Battlestar Galactica or whatever piece of fiction or something that's going to enrich the franchise, yeah, there's a large amount of ego that says my name will be on the cover and I rock. But there's also the fact that in the end, if it doesn't make the franchise better than when you went into it, it wasn't worth publishing. Mm. You know, like it that so. With Tales from the Forbidden Zone, for example, we received pitches not just about the typical chimps and gorillas and orangutans and human mutants and mutes, but also bonobos and gibbons, you know, things that you don't normally see associated. Although Marvel did do that, I should say they did have a gibbon, but. So that was fun. Dinosaurs, you really don't associate with Planet of the Apes. So that book, from our perspective, was an effort to leave something new in the franchise, because These were writers, mostly, some of them were returning, but most of the writers had never worked on the franchise before. And some of them did things that nobody would have expected, like a Planet of the Apes story set in Asia, for example.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I guess I'm kind of going on a tangent here, but what goes into writing, creating new material for a universe, should be, in my opinion, am I offering something of value, or am I just throwing my name on it? Because I get to add another credit to my name. And I think that that second one is the wrong reason to be doing it. Like if somebody asked me, for example, to start writing, My Little Pony fiction, I'd have to say no, because I know three things about My Little Pony. They're mine, they're small, and they're ponies.
Right.
Everything else about them. So all I could really do in doing that would be to make the franchise worse.
That's a really good perspective.
Yeah.
So, as we kind of start wrapping up, I know that you share a lot of stuff on social media about your comics collection. Which we can see, our audience
can see.
It's
only three of you can see, but none of those listeners.
Right, yeah. But I feel like your shelves are like a backdrop on your Twitter page or something. Oh, I feel like I've seen them before.
And that's just a part of it, by the way.
Right, yeah. I know you have quite a large collection. But some of the stuff you share on social media, which I think is really fun, is like the weird unlicensed media that you find from foreign countries.
I get a kick out of that stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so what are some of the weirdest or coolest or like strangest objects in your collection of this media?
Some of the strangest things that I have, I mentioned before that my friend Ben had hit me up with that TV 21 issue, and that started me on a path I hadn't even considered. Well, is there stuff published outside the United States? Okay. And then the internet happened. And I said, I don't need a bank account. I started looking around and discovered that there was actually other stuff too, like my friend Mark Martinez who also has a Star Trek comics website. He and I have been for years helping each other find obscurities that nobody in their right mind would want to own, let alone spend money on. But some of the stranger things. Let's see. In 1980, there was a there was an adaptation in China of Star Trek, the motion picture. I wish I could hold this up for the viewers to see. First of all, it's the size of my palm. So it's really small.
Oh, yeah.
That I didn't know, by the way, from the pictures until it finally showed up from a guy in China who found one for me. I was expecting a comic book and I was like, what the? It is really small. But, The artist had never seen Star Trek and hadn't watched the movie. And so Spock is Ayatollah Khomeini. Ilea is Ursa from Star Trek, from Superman 2.
Oh, wow.
I think Captain Kirk, it looks like Colonel Steve Trevor. In Air Force uniform. The Starfleet looks like the U.S. Air Force. The Klingons can only be described as demons from Doctor Who. So that one's pretty bizarre. Other ones I have found, a set of six comics of Planet of the Apes from Indonesia, which are really cool, actually. They're well-written and well-drawn. And have nothing to do with Planet of the Apes. let's see. Because there's things like, Aladdin mythology is worked into it, for example.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but it's wild stuff. I don't know. Jeez. Like Star Trek comics from Indonesia where they're wearing pink, you know.
Sure, yeah.
So, yeah, some wild, wild stuff. And the question would become, well, why would I want this stuff? The answer is because you don't have it. No, I'm joking about that last one. The truth is I just like finding it and scanning it and then posting it online so people can see it. Because what got me into all of this in the first place was the idea that I think it's fun to find things people don't have and share them, because it's a sense of community, you know, I wouldn't have these things if other people weren't sharing them with me. So it's a pay it forward model.
Yeah.
I find these things, it's really cool. You've probably never heard of it. So here.
Yeah.
Look at it. There Gaze upon its absurdity.
Yeah. I think you posted one this morning. Was it like an Italian Spider-Man comic or?
You know, I don't even know what that was. this wasn't so much an obscurity that I found. This was more of a joke. Somebody had posted a picture of what looks like an Italian Spider-Man comic. And sometimes the funniest stuff comes out of foreign comics, because something that means something in one language means something totally different when viewed from an American standpoint. And the cover says "The Terror of MAGA" in capitals, MAGA. And I just thought, that is so freaking hilarious. So I just posted it and said, "Submitted without comment, Italian Spider-Man fighting the terror of MAGA."
How relevant.
We need Italian Spider-Man. We need him. I mean, I don't actually own that one. That's insane. But what I do own is a Spider-Man issue from the 70s, published in Mexico, in which the villain is General Urko from the Planet of the Apes TV series.
Oh, wow. So it was like an unexpected kind of crossover.
Yeah, and if you go to Hunter's Planet of the Apes archive, it's a pretty much the Planet of the Apes fan website, you can find scans of it that I posted for Hunter and submitted so everybody can read it. But I also translated it into English because I'm just that freaking crazy. It's what I do when I find foreign comics, is I will actually, if I can translate it, I will. If not, I will find someone who can. And then I reletter them in English and post scans, because if I have to suffer through this insanity, so do you. But the Spider-Man story is actually really wild, because the idea behind it is that it's a guy. This is so insane. The villain is a sci-fi geek who is obsessed with General Urko because he's awesome. That's the idea. So he's a fan of the Planet of the Apes TV shows. And here's the kicker, if you know Planet of the Apes. The outfit that he makes for himself to call himself Urko is orange, which means he's a fan of the Planet of the Apes cartoon. So the villain is a fan of General Urko, who has Fred Flintstone's voice. And he creates for himself a supervillain persona running around as an orange armored gorilla who sounds like Fred Flintstone and commits crimes because he's awesome. That's what this villain's premise is. And I just, honestly, that's perfection. You cannot top that. After you've read this, you can just toss away your comics.
Oh, man, I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on our little show and sharing your time with us, Rich. Is there anything that you'd like to kind of plug for us?
Well, there's a crack in my ceiling I need to plug. let's see. Well, okay. Upcoming work, the Dark Shadows book that I just mentioned, which is called Running Home to Shadows. It'll be out from Becky Books in May. And the sad thing there is that the reason it's called Becky Books is that Jim Beard's wife, Becky, passed away a couple years ago.
Oh,
and she was a Dark Shadows fanatic. She was going to be among the contributors. And so he launched an imprint called Becky Books, and Becky was really sweet. So this is a great way to honor her. The Stargate book is called Unauthorized Off-World Activation. And I thought that was damn clever, because the book's unauthorized. John Ordover came up with the title. We had called it Chevron 7 Locked. And he said, no, you should call it this. And we went, Well, yes, we should. And that'll be out from Sequart probably by June.
Oh, wow.
And that's pretty much it. If people go to richhandley.com, it's H-A-N-D-L-E-Y, richhandley.com, they can follow my blog, and I announce all upcoming projects there.
That's awesome. And we can also follow you on Twitter.
Is yes, you can.
Rich Handley Trek.
I will have to look because I don't. I never look myself up, right? So I think that's what I called myself. Yeah, at Rich Handley Trek. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, awesome. Which, looking back, is really geeky, and I wish I'd just called myself Rich Handley. I don't know why I did that.
Well, I mean, yeah, you know what?
I guess I had to.
Yeah, yeah, wherever your allegiance lies, right?
That's the thing, is like, I guess at that point when I launched it, I was doing the graphic novel collection, but it was really short-sighted. It's like if you're in your 20s and you get a tattoo that says, you know, your girlfriend's name on it, and then you don't marry her. It's really short-sighted.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. This thank has been Rich. An absolute delight to talk to you.
Absolutely. Anytime you want to do this again, I'd love to. This was fun.
All
definitely,
right.
Definitely. Definitely.
We will definitely ring you up. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
Thanks so much, Rich.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.